Well, now, I want to go into the subject finally. If we say that Zen is a certain kind of understanding of the world, a certain kind of awareness of the world, what kind of awareness is it? It's very often said, especially in the writings of Suzuki, that Zen lies beyond the intellect, beyond logic, that it is not accessible, that this kind of understanding is not accessible to reasoning processes, to intellectual processes. What exactly does this mean? I think, that from some points of view, this way of talking is misleading. Because when we say intellectualizing, and the Japanese say intellectualizing, we don't necessarily mean the same thing. For example, when the Indians say the knowledge of Vedanta is not to be obtained from books, this has a very specific meaning. It means that the books are only lecture notes and have to be explained by a teacher. Take the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali. The first verse in it says, "Now yoga is explained." Period. Second verse, and so on. The teacher will say, this is just to remind him. Just in the same way as musical notation for the Indians is not something you read while you play. It's just to remind you of the basic form of the melody. So he will say, the word now indicates that something had to go before this. There's a preparation. And the preparation is thus and so, that you should have learned before you started studying yoga at all. So the word now gives him the clue for his pitch. And so in the same way, the Upanishads, their laconic style, they are notes. This is especially true of the Brahma Sutras. And you go right down here is Radhakrishnan's translation of the Brahma Sutras, and you see these funny little laconic verses from the sutra, and then pages of Radhakrishnan's commentary. That's the original reason why it said you can't get it from books. But now, so we've got to go into what is meant by the difference between intellectual understanding and intuitive understanding. Because so many people say about this when you talk about these deep matters, I understand what you're saying intellectually, but I don't really feel it. And I often say to people who make that remark, well, I don't think you understand it intellectually. Because the intellect and the feelings aren't really two different compartments of the mind. You know, Jung has a schema of the mind as having four functions: intellect, feeling, intuition, and sensation. But these are only, as it were, colors in a spectrum. The spectrum of light is continuous. Red is not in a different compartment from blue. It's all one spectrum, and so in the same way, we have one mind, and it has various different ways of functioning. I was being ribbed by a psychologist the other day because he was kidding me that I was only proficient in words. You know, I put on a great talk, but I didn't understand it otherwise, he said. I said, don't you put down words like that. Words are noises in the air. They are patterns of thought, patterns of intellect, like a fern. Do you put down a fern because it's got a complicated pattern? No, you say the fern is real. It's a living, natural thing. Well, I say, so are words. I'll make patterns in the air with words and make all sorts of concepts and string them together, and they're going to be great. And so don't you put it down. It's a form of life like any other form of life. And so, indeed, Zen has an intellectual aspect. The intellectual aspect of Zen is known in Japanese as Kegon, K-E-G-O-N. In Chinese as Hua Yun. This is it. Hua Yun in Chinese, Kegon in Japanese. And this is, Hua means flower. The school, the flower garland, the school of what is called in Sanskrit Gandhavyuha. I won't write that up on the board, you don't need to remember that. Gandhavyuha. Well, this is the most sophisticated form of Mahayana philosophy. And when we were talking this morning about Jiji Muge, the mutual interpenetration of all things and events, that is the philosophy evolved in this school. And the fifth patriarch of this school in China was also a Zen master. His name was Shumitsu. And so with him, the two channels flow together. And just as in yoga, there are various forms of yoga. There's bhakti yoga, which is a feeling kind of thing. It's devotional, emotional. Karma yoga is practical and active. And so jnana yoga is intellectual. But you might say, so many people now have difficulty in seeing the bridge between the intellectual understanding, which is to say, you know the words, but you don't get a real sense of the meaning so that your sense experience is changed. When we say an intuitive understanding, this word intuition is awfully vague. Zen understanding is sensuous. It's something that you feel, not so much in an emotional way, as in a direct way, when you feel that something is hard. As they say, it is like tasting water and knowing for yourself that it's cold. It's a sensation, a physical sensation. But now, how is the intellect related or unrelated to physical sensation? Well, what difference does it make to your sensation whether you think when the sun rises that the sun is rising, or whether you know that the earth is revolving on its axis and going round the sun? Is the sensation of a person who does not know that the earth is revolving on its own axis and going round the sun the same as the sensation of a person who does, when he sees the sunrise? Or let's take another question. There are people in this world, who, primitives we would call them, whose number system only extends to one, two, three, many. They don't differentiate after three. For those people, it can never be a fact that a table has four corners. It has many corners. And they can't differentiate clearly between a five and six cornered table, because they have no concept system to give them the cue. Or you can take an illustration like this. They're very simple. It all depends on concept. Now, if you have no concepts, that drawing is simply a flat surface pattern. But supposing it's been explained to you that it's a cube, then you can imagine and actually sense three-dimensionality in it. Now then, let's go further and ask, which surface of the cube is in front? Is it the one with corners A, or is it the one with corners B? You can see it either way, you see? You can make either one the front one. And once you've caught on to the idea, it is a sensation for you. You actually feel it. So it is, in this is the difference, you see. Concepts lead to sensations. And therefore false concepts lead to illusions. And we can know all kinds of cases of optical illusions when, for example, you know, you have the two lines here that are of exactly equal length. But if we do this to one and this to the other, wowee, suddenly that one's grown short. That has to do with our concept influencing our sensation. So it is a point in Zen that we have a concept of our own existence and of the world which is fallacious. It is going to help us get rid of that concept so that we will have a new sensation. Now, people then get worried and say, well, are we just going to exchange one hallucination for another? How do you know when you know that you know? What's the test of truth about something that you feel? You say, well, I can feel that I'm Napoleon or that I'm being persecuted by the Freemasons or something like that, and or the FDA, and this is a hallucination. Even though I might feel it very strongly. And so we, in our culture, we have a test of truth, which is science. We say if something can be demonstrated scientifically, then we're inclined to believe that it's not a hallucination. All right, let's go along with that. I think this is rather relative, but still, I will always, in any argument, grant the premises of the person who wants to argue with me. We'll just take it from there. Let's take it that science, that things like biology and physics are ways of discovering the truth. Let's grant that. Well, the hallucination of being a separate ego will not stand up to biological tests. From the point of view of biology, the individual organism is in the same behavior system as the environment. The organism and the environment constitute a single system of behavior, which is not deterministic nor voluntaristic. It's neither. It just is that the two are one activity. So they call this field the organism environment, and ecology is the study of fields like that. So when I go into academic circles where people find that matters mystical are not at all respectable, I don't talk to them about mystical experience. I talk to them about ecological awareness. It's just a matter of preserving correct etiquette and nomenclature. When in Rome, do as Rome does. So, from a biological point of view, it is perfectly clear that every individual instance of life is a function of the whole universe. This is even more clear in quantum theory. And so the thing then you might ask this question. But you scientists, biologists and physicists, who understand this to be so, you still go on behaving as if you were separate egos. And you still feel that way, don't you? and they have to confess that they do, that their theory is only still at the point of being theory. It hasn't convinced them, so far as they themselves are concerned, because they are still under the social hypnosis, which we were all conditioned to in childhood, which made us feel to be separate egos. So Zen is a process, if you like, of dehypnotization, which takes away the concepts such as these tricks here, which give us the hallucination, as this gives us a hallucination. And then when we find out what things are like when the concepts have been taken away, then we can say to the biologist, isn't that just the way you said it was? And he has to agree. So what we arrive at is a state of sensation, I'll call it that rather than feeling, which is far more in accord with the findings of science than the ordinary sensation we have of being separate individuals. But the way in which Zen is non-intellectual is not so much that it regards intellection as something always false and misleading. Zen begins by taking away the concepts and trying to see what it would be like to view the world without concepts. Then when you've got a new view, you can refabricate new concepts to try and explain now how it is that you see. And thus, for this reason, many Zen masters, people like, well, Suzuki was not formally speaking a Zen master, but he had the most profound understanding of Zen, but he's also a great intellectual and a scholar. This man I'm mentioning, Shumitz, was a great scholar. And in the history of Zen, there have been physicists in modern times and scholars of all kinds, because Zen does not rule out the life of the intellect. It only says, do not be hoaxed by concepts. Now then, is Zen illogical? Illogical is not the right word, because what appear in Zen often to be paradoxes are statements that make perfectly good sense in another system of logic than that to which we're accustomed. We in the West are accustomed to a kind of logical thinking which is based on exclusiveness, either or. Chinese logic is based rather on both and. It is either black or white. It either is or is not. It is either so or it is not so. This is the kind of logic which is fundamental to our thinking. And so we emphasize the mutually exclusive character of categories. Is you is or is you ain't? Is it in the box or is it outside the box? So in our tests, we are always saying true or false, yes or no, and giving you only these choices. It's amusing to think that when you toss a coin to decide whether you will do it or whether you won't, you have only a two-sided coin. The Chinese are able to toss a 64-sided coin by using the Book of Changes for the same reasons that we would toss a coin for. It's a rather nice idea. Even though the Book of Changes is based on yang and yin, black or white. But you can get everything out of black and white, as I pointed out. You can get all numbers out of zero and one, which is the binary arithmetic used by computers. But at any rate, whereas we think it is either or, either black or white, both Indian and Chinese logic recognize that black and white are inseparable. They need each other. And so it isn't a matter of choice between them. To be or not to be is not the question, because you can't have one without the other. So always not being implies being, just as being implies not being. The existentialist in the West, who still trembles at the choice between being and not being, and therefore says that anxiety is ontological, hasn't seen this point yet. When the existentialist who trembles with anxiety before this choice realizes suddenly one day that not being implies being, the trembling of anxiety turns into the shaking of laughter. Same shakes, but different meaning. So in the same way, the same sensation of the world, just as you're looking at now, seeing everything that you see now, but it can have a completely different feeling to it, a completely different meaning to it. Because in our ordinary sensation of the world, what is stressed are the differentiations. The solids and the space, as I pointed out this morning, is ignored. But when you have a kind of a conceptual alteration, then suddenly you notice the physical world, just everything you're seeing now, in a completely different way. And you see that it all goes together. It's all of a piece. That every inside implies its outside, and every outside implies its inside. You say now, in the ordinary way we are conditioned to think, myself, lies only on the inside of my skin. When you do this flip, you'll discover that your outside is as much you as your inside. You can't have an inside without an outside. So if the inside is yours, the outside is yours. And you have to acknowledge that the world outside the skin is as much yours as the world inside the skin. Everybody's outside is different, just as everybody's inside is different. But eventually, everybody's outside is all the same outdoors. See, and it's in this way that we are one. Your body is in your soul, not your soul in your body. That's why the ancients were partly correct with their horoscopy. When to draw a map of a person's soul, they drew a map, a very crude map of the universe, as it was at the moment of that person's birth, seen from that place and that time. That is a picture of his mind. Because your mind is not in your head. Your head is in your mind. And your mind is the total system of cosmic interrelationships, as they are focused at the point that you call here and now. So the thing is then, if this can this become clear to us, as we say a sensation is clear, tasting water and knowing for yourself that it's cold. And this will depend upon an intellectual process. Because we get into trouble through an intellectual process, and we're going to get out of trouble through an intellectual process. But the process, from an intellectual standpoint, by which we get into trouble, could be called additive. The process by which we get out of trouble is subtractive. In the words of Lao Tzu, the scholar gains every day. The man of Tao loses every day. The scholar acquires ideas. In Zen, the intellectual operation is to get rid of ideas. And see, in other words, that all ideas are projections that we make upon the cosmic Rorschach blot. You know, the world is a Rorschach blot. It is full of wiggles. And only when we see straight lines, gridiron patterns, that we know people have been around. Because people are always trying to straighten things out. And so, straight lines. Look at the stars. How they are sprayed across the heavens. But in order to make sense of the stars, you get stellar maps and you see straight lines joining the stars in various patterns so as to make up constellations. All those joining lines are projections by which we make sense of the stars. In the same way, we make projections upon the surface of nature for the purpose of discussing it with each other. And a bossy person who's got a strong will and a powerful and compelling personality describes the world and forces everybody else to agree with him. That's the way it is. And then after a few generations, they forget that they were forced into it and thinks it's the way it is. So now let's go back then to seeing that it is the primordial Rorschach blot. Wiggles of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your names. And you see then that the difference between your inside, your ego, yourself, and the outside, the subject perceiver and the object perceived, you see that that difference is artificial. And you can confirm that realization from neurology, because the neurologist will tell you that the so-called external world which you see is experienced by you only as a state of your own nervous system. What you see out in front of you is an experience in the nerve ganglia in the back of your head. You have no other awareness of an external world except in terms of your own body. You can infer that your body is in turn something in the external world, but you only know it by union with it. You are in the external world. The biologist will tell you that you are an inseparable part of it. Part isn't even the right word. The world doesn't have parts like an automobile engine. It isn't screwed together. The world is like a body. When your body was born, it grew not by the addition of bits, but by an organic process in which the whole thing constellated itself at once, larger and larger, working from the inside to the outside. And it did that, and could only do that, in a field called the womb. And the womb could only do that in a field called a female body. And a female body could only do that in a field called human society, in a field called the biosphere of the planet Earth. Take the thing out of its field and it can't do it. Blood in a test tube cannot do what blood in the veins does, because it's not the same thing. It's in a different environment. And as words change their meaning in accordance with the context of the sentence, so things change their nature in accordance with the context of their environment. So then, from this very strictly scientific point of view, your body and everything, your mind, is not, as it is usually felt by us, to be something separated from other minds and the external world. It is all one process. But we don't feel that to be so because we have been given concepts which contradict the facts. So the concept of, say, what we might call the Christian ego does not fit the facts of life. It is a social institution which is obsolete. I want to be quite sure that you understand what I mean by a social institution. When we say social institution, people think of things like hospitals, parliaments, police forces, fire departments, and things like that. No. Marriage is a social institution. The family is a social institution. The clock is a social institution. The calendar is. Latitude and longitude are social institutions. And the ego is a social institution. In other words, a convention, from the Latin convenire, to come together, a consensus, an agreement, agreeing to a set of rules for the purpose of playing a game. And what we do is, we are apt to confuse the rules of our social game with the laws of nature, with the way things are. Even the laws of nature are social conventions. Because the laws of nature, nature is not obeying a lawgiver who says, first of all, this is the way things shall go, and then all beetles, all butterflies, all rocks, and so on, follow it. The laws of nature are our way of describing regular behavior in nature. Just as when you, what is regular? Why, regulus is a rule. And what is a rule? Why, a ruler. It is marked out in inches. It is straight. You measure things with it. But you don't find rulers growing on trees any more than you get cut-up friars out of an egg. Nature is all of a piece. Everything in it goes with everything else in it, in an eternal dance. But we chop it up for purposes of discussion and for purposes of ruling it. Laws of nature are therefore like axes, hammers, and saws. They are instruments in terms of, by using them, we control what is going on. So then, but always preserve this careful distinction between the game rules of the human game and the behavior of the world in itself. It's true, the behavior of the world in itself includes the human games. That's all part of nature. But don't try to make the tail wag the dog. So the whole point of Zen is to suspend the rules. This has to be done, of course, in a special setting. You can't just gaily walk out into the street and suspend the rules, because you create traffic confusion of every conceivable kind. But we can set up a certain environment in which we have an agreement to suspend the rules. That is to say, to meditate, to stop thinking for a while, to stop making formulations. Basically, this means to stop talking to yourself. That's what is the meaning of this term, really, in Japanese, munen. Ordinarily translated, no thought. Munen. Stop talking to yourself. As we say, talking to yourself is the first sign of madness. And because you see, if you talk all the time, you've nothing else to talk about but your own talking. You never listen to what anybody else has to say. And if all you ever listen to, though, is talking, whether your own or other people, you've nothing to talk about but talk. You have to stop talking in order to have something to talk about. So the same way, you have to stop thinking to have something to think about. Otherwise, all you're thinking about is thoughts. That's scholarship, as we practice it in the academy today. Books about books about books about books about books. But so, in order to be able to symbolize, to think, one occasionally has to suspend thought and be in a state of what I will call pure sensation. So drinking water and knowing for yourself that it's cold. Sitting just to sit. Sitting quietly, doing nothing. Spring comes and the grass grows by itself. You can take that literally or you can take it symbolically. But that is the meaning of munen, or sometimes just mushin, no mind, means being open to the way the world is experienced sensuously, but without the distortion of concepts, so as to find the original nature before any thought is made. It'll be the way you experienced it when you were first born, when before you had thought any thoughts about it. That's why it's called your original mind, the root mind. So when it's asked, who are you before your father and mother conceived you, which is one of the koans, it really means, who are you before your father and mother bamboozled you? Conceived in the sense of thought about you, taught you to conceive. What's your original mind? Come off it. Before all this started, where were you really? And to go back to that, you see, you have to take a fresh look at the world. You have to come to it unprejudiced, with your mind wiped clean. And that means clean like a mirror of all conceptions about life and what it is. Now, you see, I'm giving you conceptions in the sense that I'm talking about, say, biology or ecology or something, and they have a conception of the unity of the world. And a person who understands me and gets the conception, the difficulty is he's only got the conception. It may alter his feeling to some extent, his sensation, but not as vividly as his sensation will be altered if he looks at the world without any conceptions at all. Well, you would say, how can you stop? We think perpetually, always talking to ourselves. It's a nervous habit. And so to stop thinking, naturally one thinks up certain technical helps. Concentrate on breathing. Think of nothing but your breathing, in and out, in and out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Or look at a point of light and think of nothing else but the point of light. Concentrate, concentrate, concentrate. This helps you to eliminate all concepts from the mind, except what you're concentrating on. Then the next thing is to get rid of the point you're concentrating on. Now, most people think that means a blank mind. No. Do you see, you concentrate on something in order to cause the thought process, the verbalizing, to stop. Then when you take away the point of concentration, you are simply perceiving the world as is without verbalizing, because the verbalizing has been stopped by the trick of concentrating. Concentration is only preliminary. Samadhi, or jhana, Zen, is not concentration in the ordinary sense, like staring at a point or thinking of one thing only. It is after concentration has stopped that you've taken away the point on which you concentrated, and you're open to the world with your naked senses. See that. Now that is the foundation experience. After you see that, and on the basis of seeing that, you can, of course, go back to concepts and construct this idea of the world, that idea, and the other idea. So this is why Zen does not involve any beliefs in any theory or doctrine. In this sense, it is not religion, if by religion you mean something which involves a system of beliefs. It is purely experimental and empirical in its approach. And it is getting rid of belief, getting rid of all dependence upon words and ideas. Not because words and ideas are evil, not because they are necessarily confusing, but because we do just happen to be confused by them. At this stage in our history, evolution, or what you will. So that really is the essential nature of the whole meditation process. The suspension of talking to yourself, either in words or any other conceptual image, numbers, or whatever you use. And so it is of interest, isn't it, that words are a form of notation. A notation of life, like musical notation, is a way of writing down music so as to remember it. When we have words, they are the essential vehicles of memory. Write it down, remember it. And they give us a wonderful control. But we pay a price for that. To the extent that we are tied to our notations, say in music, that limits our musical ability. The Hindu is not tied to notes in music. He therefore values a kind of music which is a musical instrument, drum, flute, sitar, whatever, which is immediately responsive to every subtle motion of the human organism. He therefore plays things which, if we put it into our notation, we should have to get the most freaky quarter tones and funny rhythms which our notation isn't set up for. The Hindu therefore rejoices in the extreme subtlety of a flute responsive to human breath, an organic phenomenon. When he listens to our music, it all sounds like a military march because of the regular beat and the fixed harmonic intervals. It all sounds very, very structured and rigid. So in the same way, when you get free from certain fixed concepts of the way the world is, you find it is far more subtle than you thought it was. That human relationships, situations, are amazingly subtle. And you gain a facility for understanding them, not through conceptualizing them, but through asking your brain how it would deal with them. See, your brain is an organ like your heart, and it can deal with situations without having to think about them. The brain is not a thinking organ. Well, but one of its functions is thinking. The brain does a lot of things other than thinking. It's as if you had a fantastic computer in your skull, and it's a good idea to use it. And as we say, our brains are only 15% efficient. That's a way of talking. It's saying that really that what we call thinking is only 15% of the brain's activity. The brain is very active, controlling all our organic processes, our gland functions, our digestion, our circulation, everything. The brain is in control. The whole autonomic nervous system. So Zen proposes that you learn to use your nervous system. It's much more wonderful than you would ever suppose. And it gives you practice. The koan is, to a great extent, a situation in which you get practice for letting your nervous system answer questions and pass through problems instead of just your conscious thinking process. The conscious thinking process will not solve the puzzles. The brain will. Well, let's take an intermission.